you will pay.
Meanwhile, condemnations have poured in from around the world, even from those considered close allies and supporters of Trump.
Unreservedly condemn encouraging people to behave in the disgraceful way that they did in the Capitol. And all I can say is I'm very pleased that the president-elect has now been duly confirmed in office and that democracy has prevailed.
It is tragic that people lost their lives in the events of this night, but for me it is a sign of hope that the Congress continued its work that night. And now we also have the confirmation of the election victory of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. The United States of America will open, as it must, a new chapter in its democracy in less than 2 weeks.
Und das sind alles Themen, da steht, after 4 very barren years that we are leaving behind, we are now looking forward to 4 fruitful years of good cooperation.
Trump only has a few days left of his term, but it seems that's too long for some. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi described the president's actions as an unspeakable assault on the nation and its people, joining those calling for him to be impeached yet again. Bianca Rahimi, London.
All right, let's discuss that story a little further with political commentator Mick Napier, who joins me from the Scottish capital, Edinburgh. It's great to have you on the show. I guess we can begin by getting your reaction to the events of the past couple of days with the knowledge that the American president has just said that he won't be attending the Biden inauguration on January 20th.
It was inconceivable that he would be able to attend. He's a man who doesn't like to lose. But look, this monstrous figure who came into the presidency calling all Mexicans rapists, who called the white supremacists, the neo-Nazis marching in Charlottesville, fine people. It could only end in disaster. And what's interesting is that until the final disaster of the last few days, when I have been glammed onto my TV sets with millions of other people, how is it possible for so many people to support this creature? Not just the British Prime Minister, who at one time said that Donald Trump should be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, but the majority of the Republican Party and so on and so on. Every success has 100 fathers, every failure is an orphan. While Trump seemed to be getting the support, amazing the number of people who supported him and who now, like rats, are deserting the good ship Trump. But it's not all been bad news, because when we look at what happened in Georgia, where white supremacists and racists have been the politically dominant faction, during this period, mobilization of voters by black and white people alike has turned the tables on these people.
Exactly.
And Georgia has come into it. So there's some good news. There's a lot of good news here, as well as this monstrous figure exiting from the stage.
And that Georgia ignominy. Victory was eclipsed, sort of, by the events in Washington D.C.,
yes.
But it is obviously good news. As you say, the fact of the matter is that more than 70 million people have voted for Trump on the November 4th elections, many of whom are convinced, thanks to Trump again, that the election was fraudulent. Now, Biden really does have his work cut out for him in bringing the country together. Whether or not can he do that?
I'm convinced that he can't. So many American people have an awareness which this monstrous figure of Trump tapped into, but they have an awareness that the American political system is abysmally corrupt, that they do have the worst politicians that money can buy, and everything is up for negotiations in smoke-filled rooms. Not just the Israeli lobby, but every other lobby as well can buy politicians. It's very clear, very corrupt. So it was partly revulsion at this system which led many foolish people into the arms of Donald Trump. And by the way, they're not all white supremacists and neo-Nazis. Certainly Trump courted these people. But there's also a lot of people who have a great suspicion of the federal government for very good reason. No health service, cities of people living on the streets.
Right.
It's absolutely a shocking system.
Mick Napier, one final question and your concisest answer. What do you think is going to be Trump's legacy?
Hatred, open racism, but it's also very difficult to tell, because I think Trump is about to be crushed by his opponents in the government. And what if he were successful, his legacy would be racism and hatred against foreigners. But it's difficult to see beyond the next couple of days, to be honest.
It sure is. Mick Napier, political commentator in Edinburgh, thank you.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Well, we're going to stay with the events in the U.S. Capitol and how they have revealed the way power works in the United States and for whom. I want to talk about that with our very own Richard Sedan. And Richard, one question you and I raised right at the outset was you look at those rioters and imagine how they would have been treated if they were black. And it turns out we're not the only ones asking that question.
Exactly. I mean, we've learned a few things from the incredible scenes in the Capitol over the last couple of days. And one of the things we've learned, as this headline shows, is white supremacy was on full display and there was a double standard seen in the police response. Now, a lot of people are making a connection, saying that, look, if these protesters were black or Muslim or both, they would have been treated completely differently. But we saw some interesting examples. There's one video of the police officer literally opening the gate, allowing scores of protesters in, many of them, of course, white supremacists. Now, I should say, of course, there were police who were, of course, doing their job and protecting the area. But we also saw a video, for example, of a police officer taking a protester, taking a selfie with a police officer. You know, these are unprecedented scenes. It's hard to imagine these protesters being treated in a different way if they were from a different demographic. I just want to bring up a couple of reactions on that point, if I can. Oscar says, the police would do next to nothing. They literally directed the white supremacists to Schumer's office. Coups happen because of the support of the military and the police. 84% of the police vote Trump. Overwhelmingly, the police helped this happen. And also on that point, MJ tweets, the police helped them storm the building. If the rioters were black, we'd have seen several dead bodies. Police were taking selfies with them. America is twisted. Read up on the Tulsa massacre and how the state gave white supremacists weapons to destroy a black Wall Street. Now, Saeed, one of the other major viral talking points videos was, of course, the shooting of one of the protesters, Ashley Babbitt.
Babbitt, Richard, a former Air Force veteran, apparently, trying to break into the main hall of the U.S. Congress, apparently.
Exactly, of 14 years. And actually, the scenes we saw there, I believe Mike Pence and other senior members of the government were beyond the barrier in the chamber there, which of course led to the shooting. A number of reactions to that video, which was circulating. Ruben on Twitter said, "Oh right, so shooting unarmed protesters is okay then. I wonder when the US will be lecturing other countries about that. One thing is for sure, the lecture won't be from the moral high ground any longer." And there's a lot of tweets making this connection between the image America likes to put forward and the scenes we've seen over the last few days. Another developing aspect to this story, Saeed, is other leaders condemning the scenes. And one thing I want to pick up on, actually, and a lot of people have mentioned this, Boris Johnson taking to his platform to condemn the scenes. Basically, a lot of people find the notion of Britain condemning, the undermining of democracy as highly hypocritical, because Britain has been involved with her allies, people would say, doing this around the world for many, many years. And so a lot of people are highly critical of Boris Johnson, and they see him as very similar to Donald Trump. Tom actually tweeted on this aspect of the story, and Tom says, the audacity of Boris Johnson to condemn the events in the US, the very Prime Minister who utilised the same tactics to divide and conquer the UK, all in pursuit of personal gain. Sickening, hypocrisy.
Hypocrisy. And Richard, we're fresh out of time. We're going to have to leave it right there. Richard Sedan with that story. Richard, thank you as always. Time to look at some other stories now. China has refused calls from the European Union and the United Nations to release Hong Kong activists arrested on January 6th on charges of conspiring with external forces when it comes to internal affairs. More than 50 activists linked to violent unrest during the 2019 political protests were detained for questioning under the country's national security law. Authorities believe the activists helped run an unofficial primary to pick opposition candidates ahead of Hong Kong elections. Suspected foreign interference is thought to have played a significant role in 2019's upheaval, which inspired the country's national security law. The European Commission says it secured 300 million extra doses of the new Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccine after growing criticism that it had not done enough to secure jabs for the entire bloc. The EU now has the capacity to vaccinate 380 million people. That's more than 80% of the bloc's population. In total, 600 million vaccines will be available, the majority of them from April. In Germany, lawmakers have criticized the decision to give the Commission the handling of the vaccines for all member states. The World Health Organization has called on European countries to do more to curb a new variant of coronavirus first detected in the UK. The organization's regional director for Europe, Dr. Hans Klug, said that 22 countries in the region have detected the mutation in their COVID patients and that this is alarming. The new variant is said to be 70% more transmissible than its predecessors, making it more difficult to keep in check. Earlier this week, the UK reported its highest daily deaths and infections from the virus since the peak of the pandemic in April last year. Ukrainians have held Orthodox Christmas celebrations despite the pandemic and widely without masks and social distancing. The nation has reported more than a million cases and over 20,000 deaths. Yet the government placed no restrictions on Christmas festivities this year. People visited restaurants and Christmas markets without masks, although the government had announced it would be placing the country under a nationwide lockdown from January 8th. Reports have claimed that Britain is the least racist country in Europe, despite evidence from the government's own sources that institutional racism and racist attacks remain prominent in British life. Press TV's Richard Sedan asks if Britain really is the least racist country in Europe.
While many people do indeed argue that Britain is less of a racist country than others, the reality, according to experts on the ground like Lee Jasper, is a far cry from the image some would like Britain to have.
In the United Kingdom, we have more inter-ethnic, inter-religious cohabitations and marriages than any other place in the world. But when you look at the scale of institutionalized racism and systemic disadvantage, then we compare with America or some other countries around the world where racism and its institutional character is much more profound.
We have a big feeling of entitlement in Britain as it is as a culture. So to say that Britain is the least racist country in the world, I believe that's another cover-up story that they always tend to try to put on this country and even around Europe, around racism, to try and cover up the reality that you still are very racist in your views towards people around people of other cultures.
While many are quick to point the finger at street racism, many more are making the connection between institutional and structural racism and power as the real issue.
In fact, what we've seen on average is two immigration bills being introduced every single year since 2020. And so we're just ratcheting up, making it more difficult, making more hostile immigration legislation to the extent now where, you know, we're deporting black British citizens to countries that they've never ever been to and have no association with.
To talk about immigrants in such a way, to talk about people, human beings that need help, and come here, a country you keep promoting to the world, because I've been around the world, I've lived in other countries, and I've heard their perception of Britain. They look at Britain as a haven, as like almost like a safe place from the problems that exist in the world that are killing people. So when they come here, they see the farce.
For many communities, and especially young black people, the police remain one of the main reasons as to why Britain is not the anti-racist utopia that many try to frame Britain's image around.
They've come to understand very quickly that they're third-class citizens living in a supposed first-class democracy. And that, as we've seen just this week, with the announcement that 9 out of 10 young people in youth offenders establishments in the United Kingdom are BME offenders. 61% of them are black. The rest are made up of Muslim and other ethnic minorities. I mean, that is a catastrophic figure.
They haven't helped. They've made the problem worse. When you put more police on the streets searching more black young people, you've got to understand causality, you know. Action, reaction, action, reaction. It's going to keep going on and on until people go to war.
While many would argue progress has been made, the reality of racism in Britain for those experiencing it, the number of racist attacks shown by police's own figures, and the systemic disparities in housing, healthcare and employment and so on, paints a very different picture indeed.
Well, two stories lined up for this segment. First, the gruesome murder of 11 minors from Pakistan's Persian-speaking Shia Hazara community in the country's Balochistan province. Condemnation of the Prime Minister Imran Khan's reaction. Well, let's bring in Robert Carter to give us the details on the ground and also the reaction online. Robert, good evening.
Good evening, Saeed. Well, thank you very much for introducing the subject as well as you did. Obviously, this story has been in the news and on social media for a couple of days now. But the latest reaction that I can bring you is a speech made by the Prime Minister Imran Khan, who has caused absolute outrage since issuing it. He appears to have accused the families and the protesters, the Shia protesters, of blackmailing him into trying to get him to go and visit the region following the attack. Now, just to clarify, he has made clear that he condemns the incident and so on, but this unusual statement comes after several days of renewed protest by the region, where, of course, the Prime Minister has yet to visit and offer his condolences in person. We actually have a snippet of speech which has caused so much outrage. Perhaps we'll play that now and see what the Prime Minister had to say.
I sent them a message saying we met all your demands, and in addition you are demanding that the Prime Minister should come before they're buried. This is just like blackmailing the Prime Minister. If this happens, everyone will start blackmailing the Prime Minister. I told them as soon as the burial is over, I will visit Quetta and meet the grieving family.
That must have ruffled a lot of feathers, Robert.
It did, Saeed, especially on social media, so perhaps I'll bring you some of the reaction now. I've gone for the more moderate responses, just obviously to be as fair as I possibly can to the subject. Let's bring the first tweet up and see what was said. It was from a user, Shabir, who's tweeting from Pakistan. They said that Imran Khan just said that the Hazaras are blackmailing him to visit. Shias, the next time you have to vote, remember it well. The next tweet I have, again, bringing more criticism to Imran Khan here, to the professor, who says, our Prime Minister has achieved a new low today. The most insensitive statement by a person who lacks the basic concept of empathy. Being a Prime Minister doesn't make you above the people. And the third and final tweet I can bring you on this, again, more unfriendly comments saying to the Prime Minister. It says here that so the people who have lost their whole families for no reason are now blackmailers only because they demand their head of state to condone them. So obviously, difficult situation for the Prime Minister. I suspect he'll be doing a little bit of damage control going forward.
Let's quickly move on to your second story, Rob, and please keep it to two tweets if you can. And this one on the Israeli Prime Minister blaming the third lockdown in the occupied territories on the new variant of COVID here in the UK.
Absolutely. So the Israeli regime's Prime Minister has referred to it as the British mutation, which he claims is behind the latest spike in cases there. So obviously, this is, of course, following on from other media outlets who have referred to this new strain as the British virus. So it seems as if we're now seeing, rather than it being known as the China virus, a term coined by US President Donald Trump, it's now being referred to as the British virus or the British munition. But also what I want to mention in the quick time I have is that ultimately the Israeli regime has been criticized for other things too, like the fact that they're not allowing or handing out, distributing the vaccine to Palestinians, even Palestinians living in the occupied territories, which are currently being administered by the Israeli regime and their forces. And this is from a regime which claims that it's not an apartheid regime, but this of course is the latest example to suggest, well, actually it is, and this has been noticed online. So very quickly, the first tweet I have, it should be from Zainab. It's Zainab says, and again, deafening silence across the world on Israel's inhumane decision. The illegal Zionist state also said it would exclude Palestinian prisoners from being vaccinated. And then the final tweet, let's bring that up now and see what was said. Again, criticism of the Israeli regime here from Nuruddin, who says, it is there in their law to be kind to Israelites only. This is absurd. And what Islam teaches is for us to be kind to every person, no matter what their religion. So comparing the beautiful religion of Islam, which is there to help people, and the Israeli regime, which is out to get people, especially if you're a Palestinian.
Precisely. Robert Carter. Robert, thank you. All right, our time is literally up. Thanks for joining us, and goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome to the program. The article you're about to hear has been authored by Dennis Uberby and carries the title, Can a Computer Devise a Theory of Everything? Might be possible, physicists say, but not anytime soon, and there's no guarantee that we humans will understand the result. Once upon a time, Albert Einstein described scientific theories as free inventions of the human mind. But in 1980, Stephen Hawking, the Cambridge University cosmologist, had another thought. In a lecture that year, he argued that the so-called theory of everything might be achievable, but that the final touches on it were likely to be done by computers. The theory of everything is still not in sight, but with computers taking over many of the chores in life, translating languages, recognizing faces, driving cars, it is not so crazy to imagine them taking over from the Hawkings and the Einsteins of the world. Computer programs keep discovering new ways to beat humans at games like chess, which have been studied and played for centuries. Why couldn't one of these marvelous learning machines let loose on an enormous astronomical catalog or the petabytes of data, discern a set of new fundamental particles, or discover a wormhole to another galaxy in the outer solar system? At least that's the dream. To think otherwise is to engage in what the physicist Max Tegmark calls carbon chauvinism. In November, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where Dr. Tegmark is a professor, cashed a check from the National Science Foundation and opened the metaphorical doors of the new Institute for Artificial Intelligence and Fundamental Interactions. The Institute is one of seven set up as part of an effort to galvanize work in artificial intelligence. The MIT-based Institute, directed by Jesse Thaler, a particle physicist, is the only one specifically devoted to physics. It includes more than two dozen scientists from all areas of physics, from MIT, Harvard, Northwestern University, and Tufts. What I'm hoping to do is to create a venue where researchers from a variety of different fields of physics, as well as researchers who work on computer science, machine learning, or artificial intelligence, can come together and have dialogue and teach each other things, Dr. Thaler said. Ultimately, I want to have machines that can think like a physicist. Their tool in this endeavor is a brand of artificial intelligence known as neural networks. Unlike so-called expert systems like IBM's Watson, which are loaded with human and scientific knowledge, neural networks are designed to learn as they go, similar to the way human brains do. By analyzing vast amounts of data for hidden patterns, they swiftly learn to distinguish dogs from cats, recognize faces, replicate human speech, flag financial misbehavior, and much more. We're hoping to discover all kinds of new laws of physics, Dr. Tegmark said. We have already shown that it can rediscover laws of physics. Last year, in what amounted to a sort of proof of principle, Dr. Tegmark and a student, Silviu Marian Udrescu, took 100 physics equations from a famous textbook and used them to generate data that was then fed to a neural network. The system sifted the data for patterns and regularities, and recovered all 100 formulas. Like a human scientist, it tries many different strategies, modules in turn, the researchers wrote in a paper published last year in Science Advances. And if it cannot solve the full problem in one fell swoop, it tries to transform it and divide it into simpler pieces that can be tackled separately, recursively relaunching the full algorithm on each piece. In another more challenging experiment, Dr. Tegmark and his colleagues showed the network a video of rockets flying around and asked it to predict what would happen from one frame to the next. Never mind the palm trees in the background, at the end the computer was able to discover the essential equations of motion, he said. Finding new particles at a place like CERN's Large Hadron Collider would be a cinch, Dr. Ted Marks said. Artificial intelligence likes big data, and the collider data runs to thousands of terabytes a second. Never mind that a new particle hasn't appeared in the CERN data since the discovery of the Higgs boson in 2012, despite years of frenzied examinations of every bump in the data stream. Those are curves that humans look at, Dr. Tegmark said. In 10 years, machine learning will be an essential to doing physics as knowing mathematics. For now, he conceded, there are limits to what can be achieved by the algorithm's recursive methods of problem solving, a practice known as regression. Although the machine can retrieve from a pile of data the fundamental laws of physics, it cannot yet come up with the deep principles, like quantum uncertainty in quantum mechanics or relativity, that underlie those formulae. By the time that artificial intelligence comes back and tells you that then we have reached artificial general intelligence, and you should be very scared or very excited, depending on your point of view, Dr. Tegmark said. The reason I'm working on this, honestly, is because what I find most menacing is if we build super powerful artificial intelligence computers and have no clue how it works, right? Dr. Thaler, who directs the new institute at MIT, said he was once a skeptic about artificial intelligence, but now was an evangelist. He realized that a physicist, he could encode some of his knowledge into the machine, which could then give answers that could interpret more easily. That becomes a dialogue between human and machine in a way that becomes more exciting, he said, rather than just having a black box you don't understand making decisions for you. He added, I don't particularly like calling these techniques artificial intelligence, since that language masks the fact that many artificial intelligence techniques have rigorous underpinnings in mathematics, statistics, and computer science. Yes, he noted, the machine can find very much better solutions than he can despite all of his training. But ultimately, I still get to decide what concrete goals are worth accomplishing, and I can aim at ever more ambitious targets, knowing that if I can rigorously define my goals in a language the computer understands, then artificial intelligence can deliver powerful solutions. Recently, Dr. Thaler and his colleagues fed their neural network a trove of data from the Large Hadron Collider, which smashes together protons in search of new particles and new forces. Protons, the building blocks of atomic matter, are themselves bags of smaller entities called quarks and gluons. When protons collide, these smaller particles squirt out in jets, along with whatever other exotic particles have coalesced out of the energy of the collision. To better understand this process, he and his team asked the system to distinguish between the quarks and the gluons in the collider data. We said, I'm not going to tell you something about quantum field theory. I'm not going to tell you what a quark or gluon is at a fundamental level, he said. I'm just going to say, here's a mess of data, please separate it into basically two categories. And it can do that. That is, the system successfully identified and distinguished between quarks and gluons, without ever knowing what either was. If you then ask the system if there is a third kind of object in that data, Dr. Thaler said, it starts to discover that quarks are not just one entity, but exist in different types, so-called up quarks and down quarks. And so it starts to, learn as you give it more flexibility to explore, he said. It doesn't know quantum field theory yet, but it knows to look for patterns. And that is a pattern that I was shocked that the machine would find. The work, he added, would help collider physicists untangle their results. Some physicists believe that the next great leap will come with the advent of artificial intelligence on quantum computers. Unlike classical computers, which manipulate bits of data that can be one or zero, the so-called qubits in quantum computers can be both at once. According to quantum physics, that is how elementary particles behave on the smaller scales of nature, and it allows quantum computers to process vast amounts of information simultaneously. Such machines are still in their infancy, but they hold great promise, said Seth Lloyd, a mechanical engineer and quantum computing expert at MIT, who is not part of this new Artificial Intelligence Institute. The basic insight is that quantum systems can generate patterns that are hard for classical systems to generate, Dr. Seth Lloyd said. So maybe quantum systems can also recognize patterns that classical systems recognize. Maria Spiropoulou, a physicist at the California Institute of Technology, pointed to the growing literature on quantum artificial intelligence and quantum-inspired algorithms that solve problems that we thought of as unsolvable previously. How far this could go depends on whom you ask. Could a machine produce the abstrusive and unintuitive principles of quantum theory, or Einstein's bulwark principles of relativity? Could it produce a theory that we humans can't understand? Steven Weinberg, a professor of physics at the University of Texas at Austin, called it a troubling thought that humans might not be smart enough to understand the final theory of everything. But Steven Weinberg said, I suspect in that case, we will also not be smart enough to design a computer that can find a final theory of everything. Lisa Randall, a physicist at Harvard University, wrote, I can readily imagine computers finding equations or relationships we don't know how to interpret, but that is not really different from the many measurements we cannot yet explain. Edward Witten, from the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton University, noted that although a theory of everything machine didn't exist yet, it might in the next century. If there were a machine that appeared to be interested in and curious about physics, I would certainly be interested in conversing with it.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids? That is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise their children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And we have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the program, Sister Salma.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. So, we have been talking about contentment in our previous episodes, and you've tried to explain us how we should try and inculcate this in our children, and how, you know, as parents, they like parents themselves, if they are contented, they will be able to bring it out in their children, and how they should try and, you know, bring Allah into the picture and say that it's all from Allah. Say Alhamdulillah, so the child, you know, realizes that in reality everything is from Allah.
That's right. Well, another thing that I have to add to it is that as you thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, thank Him for every matter like that appears probably small to the children's eyes. Like, for example, a house that we stay in. It's so normal for a child to come to the house, yeah? But we should learn how to appreciate the fact that we have a roof over our head, right? So these things appear to be taken for granted. Like, for example, when you come back from outside, nowadays it's so cold, right?
Yeah.
So when we come home, it feels like so good to be home back.
You say Alhamdulillah.
So, yeah, Alhamdulillah, when you really mean that,
yeah.
Okay? And for example, other small things that you have, for example, Alhamdulillah, that, you know, we woke up today in the morning and we were healthy enough to start walking and doing our things, yeah? That's even a big thing. And then sometimes out of the blue also you can remind the child that have you ever thanked about small things that we have and we take it for granted, like the eyes we have.
Yeah.
We see with our eyes, the nose we have. Have you thought about the people who can't see, you know, play a game with a child.
Read a story.
Like, don't see things and then tell me what they are.
Uh-huh.
It's very hard for him. Or walk from here to there with, you know, your eyes closed.
Mm.
It's very difficult, right? Yeah. The child will realize that what a great ni'mat Allah has given them, you know, and be contented for these little things that appear to be little, but they are great indeed.
Definitely.
That Allah has given us all these gifts. So, you know, these kind of counting the ni'mats is very important to have with the child, sessions of counting ni'mats. In fact, I heard a preacher say that we should have these kind of sessions between elders also. Sometimes, you know, it takes away that stress and that that feeling of wanting more and more. So sometimes we should, even in a family, point out to 5 of our good ni'mats that Allah has given us.
Yeah.
All in all, or maybe that day. So we usually come out to look for the big things that happen to us. Yeah, like today, for example, I got this much money. The father say, I got this much business extra that I wasn't expecting. Or the mom will say, I got a piece of gold from your dad, or things like that. But that's not the way to count your blessings. I guess just the normal blessings that come on our way every day, we have taken that so much for granted. And then when it's lost, we start really, you know, feeling bad over it. So contentment is all about that. To feel happy with what you have already. Not to look for other things that will make you more happier.
And also that is why Allah tells us that when we feel like we don't have enough, we should look at those people who don't have anything. So we look at what is below us. You know?
Exactly. I'm coming to that point now of how to instill this contentment in children. One other way is to look at people who have lesser than you. And I remember this great lady who used to homeschool her children. And part of her homeschooling was to take the children to orphanages and to old people's homes.
Yeah.
To make them realize that, look, these children, they're so little, but look at how they're playing, how happy they are. Or they have, you know, they don't have parents to look at over them and give them individual attention the way you get.
Exactly.
But look at them. They're still living and they're still Allah's creatures.
Definitely.
So this is something that we need to, inshallah, teach our children.
Inshallah.
We're exposing them to these kind of people who have lesser than us.
Yeah, definitely. So we're just going to take a short break and inshallah continue on this discussion after the break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
So welcome back to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. So you are telling us on how we can, you know, bring in this contentment with our children by showing them that there are people who have lesser than them, and to tell them that, look, you have so much, you know. and they should look at those who don't have so that they should know how much they do have.
Yes, exactly. And appreciate what they do have, right?
Yeah.
So it teaches like, see, when if you look at our explanations from the start, it teaches from a very young age. The child wants but doesn't need. So how you teach the child, and then when he wants still, you give lesser things to him of less expenditure so that the child learns to appreciate when he gets the bigger things. You don't spoil them. You explain them. And then you show them, you know, that how to not do israf through the daily things that we usually do, the clothes and the food.
Yeah.
And then you come to the outside world when you, you know, like look at others who have lesser than you. You show them the people. You can even show them pictures of such people who don't have food to eat. But we are so lucky. Explain them. We need to do something about that. And this makes a person so responsible, a child, that now that we have of what we have, we should give out what we have, right?
Exactly.
And it adds to his khidmat-e khalq. It makes him more charitable in place of getting more just thirstier for the worldly possessions.
Or feel very proud that, look and laughs at them. Oh, they don't have it.
Exactly.
I have it.
That hardly comes about, I guess, if Muslim children are Muslim. Or it's just like a quick session of feeling, oh, they don't have. Oh, I'm so sorry. That's it. But if you teach them contentment, they will learn to do khidmat-e khalq also.
Yeah.
They'll feel that now that we have little, then let's also give out of what we have.
Mm.
It'll make them charitable. And these people are very successful in the long run. Whatever they have, they will always share out.
Definitely.
So it's khidmat-e khalq also that they're doing. They're being of service to the people also. Not just satisfying their wants and their desires.
Yeah,
all the time.
So basically this would happen if the parents show them that, like if the parents do that.
Contentment, yeah. Instill them the contentment from a very young age. And then another thing is that teach the children the concept of enough also. This is enough for you.
Uh-huh.
In other things, like for example, if the child is having some cookies or some favorite chocolates or something, then you can give them one or two and tell them, now this is enough. So the concept of enough is there now.
Like there's a limit.
In practice, yeah. That this is what enough means, that you get two, though you feel like having more, but get that self-control in you, that you get two because others also want to have, and plus it's not good for your teeth, for example.
Yeah.
Okay, or you've watched enough tonight, the whatever you need to watch, your screen time. Now it's time for example, this kind of other activities.
But like to strengthen the willpower, because there's sometimes you feel like, oh no, I want to continue watching or I want to continue doing this, but because that's because you've not strengthened your willpower.
Yeah, I remember my child telling me that I want more, for example, trousers now because it's cold. But I said that you have three already, right?
Mm-hmm.
So don't you think it's enough? So yeah, let's count it. One, two and three, it's enough. Yeah, that's enough. Or now you have five. Don't we need to give up it too? It's too much. You can't even wash it always. You know, they take so long to dry. We hardly wash it. Like maybe 2-3 days apart we wash it because you just wear once outside. So she came to realize that, and she, alhamdulillah, felt the need to give. Felt, yeah, really, I have enough. Though that actual concept of enough doesn't come about, you know, like until they grow up, the contentment and the advantages of contentment. But just to give out would make her feel that, yeah, you know, I don't need it now.
Like
this,
at least
I'm content
the sense
with.
Of giving.
Yeah, a sense of contentment.
Yeah.
I'm happy with this.
Yeah.
I'm happy with whatever is distributed.
Because otherwise, like, it's quite natural that a child would be like, no, they want more. But like, if it could work out, like, at times, it's good to tell them. It's good to show them. Yeah, definitely. Thank you very much. We're just going to take a short break, and we'll get back to this discussion after the break.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back to your audience to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. You have been talking about how we can instill this concept of contentment, and we have to show them that there is a point where it's enough for the child, and how this concept of it being enough can bring about self-control and contentment and strengthening of the willpower.
And there are also some other advantages that in the long run, contentment helps to disattach from the material world faster.
Mm.
You know, when you feel that, for example, you have something and it's lost, it will make you feel that it's okay now, you know. I'll get another one,
yeah.
What I need. Because always the person has had what they needed. Not that the things are, you know, gathered more and more and more, and every time it's replaced with other things. Such children don't get disattached very fast. But children who have what they need will get very much disattached very fast, you know, of the world, material
yeah.
world. They wouldn't feel that this is so important, because we get our needs anyway.
Yeah.
So even if this is broken or burnt or whatever, I can replace that.
Yeah. That of course, we should take care of it. But if it breaks, then
yeah.
it's not like the whole world is in
it. Exactly. We should take care of it, of course. But if it does separate from us, then they still that contentment. So it helps a lot in piety and in the spiritual aspect, and gives true happiness and peace to a person. You know, the true tranquility and the nafs mutmainna is brought about when a person is content and happy with whatever they have. In fact, the way we mentioned, he feels rich with whatever he has.
Exactly.
And that's the feeling that people who want more and more want to have, that feeling of richness and power, but they it's not quenched.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
But contentment is a beauty that is quenched. This, it's like a tool that quenches your thirst. This is a secret that we as adults even need to find out, and we need to work on ourselves
yeah,
also.
Definitely. Inshallah, that we'll be able.
And also it makes one very much positive in nature, because of the peace of mind he has and the peace of heart. So he doesn't occupy his mind with wanting more and more. Now, these are hurdles in the way of, you know, paving the way of perfection.
Yeah.
So if one is positive in nature due to the tranquil heart, he'll look at the main goals in life that is suited for his own being that he came in this world for. Contentment brings so much advantages. And in the long run, he'll end up doing more in his life, because he'll give all the energy to fulfill all the goals that are set up for him by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through this contentment.
Yeah.
Contentment is something, a secret that we need to find out and inshallah work on for our children, and in the process, of course, ourselves too, because we need to firstly role model ourselves.
Inshallah, because definitely not being content is a big hurdle from reaching your goals, because
yeah.
we always feel sad about what we don't have or what we couldn't manage to do. It's just that you doing your best, you trying the most, and you just, the struggle is something very important. Just the way we spoke about, you know, that this whole process, this path, this journey is what's important. If we struggle, if we, you know, work and do our best, the other things are now secondary. What
yeah.
we get, we should always know that it is from Allah.
Yeah.
And all of this together is what's going to help us get contentment, inshallah.
Yeah, inshallah.
Thank you very much, inshallah. We hope that we can work on ourselves, because if we want our children to become better and contented, then we have to really work on ourselves as
That's
well.
That's right, absolutely.
Thank you very much, Sister Salma Khalfan, for giving us your time. Dear audience, thank you for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email englishradio@irib.ir and visit us at our website parstoday.com. Inshallah, until the next program, bi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Coming up is the news.